occurs, I can't be too mean. Here I can be.
Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. It is Monday, April 3rd, 2017. Yes, we are into yet another one in this committee. It won't be our last. So we have a combination of work sessions and public hearings. Let me say, first of all, that if any of you were here for Senate Bill 115, that will not be work today. We're going to be carrying that over. We're awaiting another amendment, and we'll see what that looks like, and we'll talk about it on Wednesday. We'll get it posted as soon as we can so everybody can take a look at it, see if that satisfies concerns. Please let me know. And Senate Bill 745, we are waiting for a fiscal on that. If it comes before the end of the session, we'll go ahead and work that bill. So what I want to do is I'm going to open jointly Senate Bills 114 and 258 because aside from their numbers, they are identical bills. I am going to ask Senators Riley and Gelser to come up and tell us about them. So.
Chair Dimbrough, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee, for your record, my name is Sarah Gelser. I'm the state senator from Senate District 8. That includes Corvallis, Philomath, Albany, Tangent, Millersburg, and the surrounding areas. I'm happy to be here today with Senator Riley on these bills that are very simple. These bills intend to repeal something we did in the short session, which was incredibly upsetting to the community that I live in. It essentially took the right of our voters in our communities away when it came to voting to make decisions about annexations. The idea of voter approval of annexation actually predates me. It was established in Corvallis in 1972, I believe I saw in the room some of the folks that spearheaded that, and it spread across the state. And the reason that it's so important is that communities really do need to have the right to establish their charters and to develop their communities in accordance with those charters. In my community, this is a tool that has been used frequently. And oddly, I think one might expect that a local government would have been contacting me to say, please pass this bill last session so that we can make decisions in our city council and not have to go to our voters. In fact, our local government was quite vocal in opposing the bill that passed earlier this year because our community so values the voice of citizens in determining how and when our community should grow. That process, that voter approval process, has led to better plans, to better developments, and has allowed annexations when it is right for the community at the right time. So I just would like to urge you in the strongest possible terms to restore the rights to the voters of my community, to restore the culture and tradition and practice that has outlasted my life, been longer than my life, of people being able to have a voice in how their community grows. So I would urge you to pass either Senate Bill 258 or Senate Bill 114. Probably doing both would be overkill. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Senator. Senator Riley.
Thank you. My testimony is going to be a lot shorter. It's pretty simple. When we had this on the floor last year, I voted no because I said at that time I'll never vote for a bill that takes away a vote of the people. And the other argument, of course, is Article 11, Section 2 of the Constitution, which says the legislative assembly shall not enact, amend, or repeal any charter or act of incorporation of any municipality, city, or town. The legal voters of every city and town are hereby granted power to enact and amend their municipal charter subject to the constitutional criminal laws of the state of Oregon.
Okay. Colleagues, any questions? Yes, Senator Bertschiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know I voted no on this last on the bill that you want to repeal.
Thank you.
I can't remember. Why was it passed?
Chair Dimbrough, members of the committee, I believe it was part of a package.
Oh, one of them lovely packages. Thank you.
So, small grand bargain.
Yeah, and if I may answer that as well, Mr. Chair. So, in fact, I don't think I put my name on the record. I'm Senator Chuck Riley. And one of the reasons it passed is because some developers have bought some large parcels of land right outside city limits, and that makes a one-owner a big piece of property. And what we did was make it so that the owners of the pieces of property annexed can, if everybody in that group agrees, we can do it. Well, when you have one owner who's a big developer, that's going to happen.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thank you both very much. Okay, I'll just call people up in order. Brian Beinlich, Rick Flacco, and Jeffrey Lamb, please, if you could come up and testify. And we have a lot of people who are signed up to speak on this. So if you could keep your remarks 2-3 minutes and start off by giving us your name, please.
Okay. I'm Brian Beinlich, and I live in the area around North Plains, which is one of the cities that has given themselves the right to vote on annexations and is very deeply affected by this bill. I wrote a letter, which you should have in front of you. I'm not going to read it to you. But the essence of my testimony, I wanted to kind of focus on what I'm going to butcher your name, sir. I'm really sorry. Senator Bartziger?
Perfect. Yeah, you did a good job.
Okay. Is it Bartziger?
He's heard worse.
Yeah, I'm a Beinlich, and people butcher my name all the time. So anyway, so you had brought up what was the reason that this bill was passed in the first place. And indeed, it was part of a package of four bills attempting to address affordable housing. So in North Plains, as soon as that bill passed, the developers immediately filed to annex two very large pieces of property right adjacent, which are in the UGB, of course, but are adjacent to the city. And that has resulted in about 600 new houses that are slated for development. And North Plains is a town of about 2,000 people. And planners generally look at about 2.2 residents per house, and so they were talking about 1,300 new residents potentially in a city, in a town the size of about 2,000 residents. It's a huge, it's about a two-thirds increase in the population of that town, which would happen essentially overnight. And based on the developments that have happened, you know, in the recent past in North Plains, those are all going to be single-family houses. And so I don't think that single-family houses, they don't fit my definition of affordable housing. And so we're going to have 600 new houses in North Plains, and I don't think we're going to have a single new affordable housing dwelling. And so I don't think this bill, Senate Bill 1573, accomplished what it intended to do. It certainly isn't doing that in North Plains. And so for that reason, I would like you to pass one or both of these bills.
Thank you very much, Brian. Rick?
Thank you, Senator Dembrough, and members of the committee for hearing my testimony. My name is Rick Flacco. I live in Philomath, Oregon, with my family. By authorizing the legislature to tear down the 100-year-old constitutional wall guarding cities from legislative overreach, Senate Bill 1573 stands in the way of every Oregonian's right to use their charters as they're intended. 1573 is expressly undemocratic and makes a mockery out of the democracy in which we live. Additionally, this bill, hastily and improperly put forth in emergency session, is forcing you to break your individual oaths of office to stand up for and defend the Oregon Constitution. My family regards it as sacrosanct fact that regardless of pressure and influence from special interests, the future planning and growth of our town will be decided by the electorate. State law dictates that the only time a legislative body is allowed to force cities to break their own charters is when the health and safety of citizens is at stake, Oregon Revised Statute 222.850. Senate Bill 1573 clearly does not meet this test. It is in direct opposition to the authority which cities and their electorates are vested with as guaranteed by the Oregon Constitution to enact and amend their own charters, previously mentioned in Article 4, Section 1, as well as Article 11, Section 2. Annexing more land has never and will never result in additional affordable housing. 1573 is simply, in my opinion, a Hail Mary from a few special interests to unlock the floodgates of increased profits for a few at the expense of many. In the year 1295, in his original summons to what would eventually be known as the Model Parliament, a foundation of our democracy, Edward I proclaimed, quote, omnes tangit ab omnibus approbator, what touches all should be decided by all. I implore you to repeal Senate Bill 1573 by supporting Senator Gelser's and Senator Riley's 258 and 114 respectively. If Senate Bill 1573 is allowed to pass, the rights of my family, fellow citizens, and the electorates in many other communities across the state will have been trampled on in an unconscionable and egregious way. Please stand up for the rights of cities to implement city charters in the ways that they were originally intended. Any bill or statute that goes against these rights represents a constitutional crisis and is a direct threat to the democracy in which we live. As a citizen, I request immediate repeal of 1573 and that you stand up for the oath of office that you took in protecting the Oregon Constitution. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Rick. Mr. Lamb.
I appreciate the opportunity to testify, Chair Dimbrough and senators. My name is Jeff Lamb. P.O. Box 248, Philomath, Oregon, and I've been involved with land use issues for approximately 25 years. OCVA is 20 years old, the organization. You've got a lot of testimony citing the constitutional provisions that say simply that the legislature shall not change a city's charter or amend it. And this has presented a real problem for the 30 plus cities that have changed their charter and amended it so that their people could be involved in how big their cities would grow and the cost analysis, the impact analysis, the things that are the meat and potato that go with growth. It's not an easy process to put a referendum on the ballot. The citizens have to gather the signatures and qualify. That's a task. Then the citizens have to run a campaign based upon the merits of the issue. Always outspent, always outgunned. We've had 30 successes from the people and 2 defeats. So once these charter amendments have taken place, in essence, the way Senate Bill 1573 was conducted with no public hearings, no notice, at the end of a special session, a tag-on bill of 4 that was to address affordable housing. I'd like to remind all of you that there's no annexation provisions in the Bend area. There's no annexation provisions in the Portland area. So the arguments that you've heard that if we get rid of people voting on annexations, this is somehow going to address the affordable house issue doesn't hold water. There's about 700,000 people that feel that they've been disenfranchised by Senate Bill 1573. If you look at the list of cities that have changed their charters, take into consideration the amount of time and money and effort that those citizens put together to change their charters. To take away their voice and their vote creates mistrust and distrust of our government.
Okay. You could wrap up, Mr. Lynn.
I will.
Thank you.
I think that you have plenty of testimony on plenty of different organizations and the particulars. I urge you to pass this out of committee with a due pass resolution and let the political process play out and have the debate on the Senate floor, and everybody can bring their best arguments. I think this will pass. I think it only missed coming out of the House by one vote. So if we can offer the public an opportunity to have their say on this, I think that that will suffice. And I really do thank you for having the hearing. We had heard that there was going to be no hearing on this, and I'm very, very, very grateful that you've allowed this to go forward.
Well, thank you for coming forward to speak. Thank you, all three of you. Oh, I'm sorry, don't leave yet.
Just a question. Yes. In 1573, and I'm trying to go, I tried to look it up and didn't find it quickly in my field. Does it require cities to be able to do this annexation, or do they have to change their charter to be able to use 1573?
It requires the city to hold no hearings and annex. So if you have property that is contingent to the city limits, and somebody comes forth and they say, we want to be annexed, they don't leave the city the discretion that we feel is necessary. Under the current situation, if a city has an annexation ordinance, part of that ordinance is you do the impact analysis on the traffic, you do the impact analysis on the schools, the water, the sewer, police, fire, everything. Under 1573, you don't do those impact analysis. The city council is directed to annex the land. And if you would like a copy of 1573, I'd be happy to get it to you.
I'll keep looking. I know it's in here. It is.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, all three of you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So we are under a time crunch, everyone. And so I realize that we need to use the timer. And so, because there are about 50 people who want to testify on two bills that we have before us. So our next panel will have Marilyn Kernitzer, Lori Stevens, and Steve McLaughlin, please. Thank you very much for coming. And Marilyn, would you like to start?
I would. Thank you, Senator Dembro and members of the committee. My name is Marilyn Kernitzer. I'm from Corvallis. And I was one of the core people who worked on the initial campaign in 1976 to get the Charter Amendment on Annexations. The father of this was the late Ed McLean. I just want to say his name for those people who may remember who he was. Our charter amendment has gone through court cases all the way to the Supreme Court and been validated. But last year, of course, as you know, Senate Bill 1573 removed our right to vote on annexation. So as Jeff was just explaining, we now cannot vote. It's just we have to say, all right, it can be annexed. The city can do it without a vote. So but they did this under the guise of readying more land for affordable housing. However, the Senate Bill 1573 did not tie the affordable housing to annexations. So that is a sort of a fallacy. Our home rule rights have been violated with passage of Senate Bill 1573. Our city charter has had home rule rights forever. I feel this was the wrong action to take. Corvallis is doing very well deciding its own destiny. We've passed more than 40 annexations since 1977, and added 3,700 some odd acres, including 379 acres of health hazard land. Only 233 acres have not been voted into the city, and those were developed outside in the county. Some annexations failed and then passed a second time, and I've got charts of all how that happened. We think developers have overbuilt student housing, and we need more family housing and senior housing. Our charter amendment has worked very well. Please let us continue to have it, and please pass either one of these bills. And so I would be glad to answer questions at any time. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marilyn. Okay.
My name is Lori Stevens. I'm an architect in Corvallis, Oregon. And so before Senate Bill 1573 went up for a vote, I had an email exchange with Senator Lee Beyer, who proposed the bill. My husband, who is a land use attorney, chimed in to the exchange, and I would like to read you his response. Dear Senator Beyer, my wife forwarded me the message you sent on February 28th. I have to say, for someone who claims to have knowledge about our land use system, your message is either patently dishonest or more likely uninformed. You state, I totally support a community's right to plan for the development level they desire, including no growth at all. No, you do not. Under Oregon law, exactly how is a community to do that? As I hope you know, Oregon law requires 20 years of buildable land to be inside the urban growth boundary. So with SB 1573, there's actually no legal way for a community to be no growth. I understand your point that the planning process is when the community should get involved, but you and I both know that rarely happens to any meaningful degree. And it certainly does not happen down to the property-by-property level. If community's comprehensive plan reflected the will of the people in that community with respect to how each property should be used, you would not need voter annexation, voter approved annexation. The fact that annexations sometimes get voted down is, in fact, proof that the comprehensive plan and the planning process did not, in fact, express the wishes of the community. With crushable properties, ones that, for instance, have significant natural areas or other community attributes, what further approved annexation also does is force developers to put forth plans that deal with the concerns of the community. That is a good thing. It enhances the community. For some communities probably don't care. Oregon is littered with them. For those communities not voting on annexations, that might be fine for their citizens. However, if you took the time to study some of the communities that have voted annexation, you would find that the most active and involved participants, they care.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Stevens. Mr. Long. I'm sorry, Mr. McLaughlin.
My name is Steve McLaughlin, retired businessman from Corvallis. I worked on several campaigns for cities. In fact, I worked in Salem, and which has the right to vote on annexations. And having lived with this for many, many years, Corvallis is obviously one of the better planned cities in the whole state. It's very well done, and the acrimony in the early years has gone away. I don't hear anybody... even real estate interests complaining about our annexation rules anymore. 80% of them have been approved. And I think the important thing is we put sunlight and transparency. We see what the project is going to be. And I think that's what the citizens really want to know is, you know, the houses, some kind of a layout, what the footprint is going to be. So it's been a very, very positive force for Corvallis and for Philomath, too. And all you have to do is go to Vancouver, Washington, to see a city that doesn't have good planning. So I'll leave it at that. And thanks for taking my comments.
Thank you. If you can make it over the bridge.
Senator, I just want to say, it looked like you didn't finish your testimony, and it was written. So if you want to, you can have it there, and we'll put it in the line, and we'll have it. Mm-hmm. We'll have written testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, thank you, all three of you. Jim Long, Richard Reed, and Peggy Lynch, please.
Good afternoon, Senators. I did submit some testimony, which you have and can read, so I'll summarize. When I moved to Oregon...
Name first.
Jim Long.
Thank you.
Tigard, Oregon. When I moved to Oregon... The big thing was land use planning. I remember Tom McCall saying, we, the citizens, need to protect this thing called Oregon. And goal one of land use laws calls for citizen involvement in every phase of the planning process. When I lived in North Plains, we spent many days and weeks knocking on doors, asking people, residents, for their signatures on a petition to place voter annexation on the ballot. We were successful getting it on the ballot, and citizens approved the requirement to have voter approval. Local votes on annexation are one of the best examples of fulfilling goal one because it can result in better proposals by developers. I was shocked, saddened to learn of its passage, the passage of Senate Bill 1573, February of 2016, and sorry that more citizens weren't involved in the process. So please consider moving these bills forward and giving them the opportunity to be considered by the larger body. Thank you.
Thank you to Senator DeDembro and the committee for allowing hearings on these critical bills. My tack is a little different. I think voting on annexations is vital.
Your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. Richard Reed, Salem, Oregon.
Great.
Sorry. With the Oregon Communities for a Voice in Annexations. And that is an important priority for me, but even more important, I think, is the fact that Senate Bill 1573 actually kind of reverses and staunches what the Oregon Constitution wants to do. Reading through testimony, it becomes obvious that community development is complicated, especially paying for it. The cash flow and timing required for community development is its Achilles heel. There are all kinds of moving parts, but money management is the most important part. Community development is weighed down by the ever-increasing fund required to pay for the infrastructure and maintenance cost backlog. The magnitude of the backlog is discussed in a recent League of Oregon studies study about water and wastewater. It's in a recent ODOT study about roads and bridges and the current budget for the city of Bend. The League of Oregon Cities leaves no doubt infrastructure funding for $7.6 billion is required for drinking water, wastewater treatment, and water storage. ODOT says the 20-year forecast budget for the state highway system is insufficient to preserve and maintain pavement and bridges in their current condition. If nothing changes, they say, we can expect a loss of $94 billion in cumulative Oregon gross domestic product by 2035 due to higher transportation costs. The current Bend budget stays on the theme. It says public safety and street preservation already comprise 87% of the general fund expenditures over there. And they'll go on to say that despite 9/10 of the general fund being dedicated to public safety and street preservation, these programs are still underfunded and require increased funding to sustain current levels of service. So all of these reports remind us of the crisis, and I just would say that repealing Senate Bill 1573 would put control back in the hands of the communities so they can deal with these costs of growth as they variously appear in those communities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Reed. Ms. Lynch.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters has numerous positions related to citizen participation and access. We support city and county home rule and have always advocated that local citizens have the right to bring matters before their fellow residents on a variety of issues. We also have studied land use since 1959 and have been active in supporting our land use planning program with local implementation, and that's the key. And it is because of this that we ask that you support Senate Bill 114 or 258. I will tell you that I was here in February of 2016 when 1573 was passed with a one-hour hearing, and it almost didn't get out of House rules because of the few of us who actually got a chance to say something about the implications of the bill. There are four provisions in 1573. The territory is included within an urban growth boundary. It is or will be subject to a comp plan. And at least one or lot or parcel has to be adjacent, and then it conforms with other requirements of city ordinances. But if the city has a voter annexation ordinance, that provision was struck. The issue for us, in part, has to do exactly with the issue of financing. In many places in Oregon, there is not a systems development charge to developers related to annexations. And if there is, in many cases, they are certainly not sufficient to pay the full bill. So a conversation between whoever wants to come into the city and the citizens who are already paying for services such as police and fire and the infrastructure such as sewer and water should have a conversation, or could if they chose to. And remember that these are local charter amendments, which means that they can be repealed by those same citizens should that conversation be had in that local jurisdiction. But our testimony is online. We just ask that you please pass one of these bills. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Peggy. Thank you all. Any questions?
Questions?
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Peggy.
Steve Frank. Steve Sear.
Can I read those?
And Aaron Doyle. Aaron. Great. Okay, Mr. Frank, you want to start us off?
Sure. Steve Frank, State in Oregon. Hi, folks. How are you doing there?
Yeah.
Good.
It's a long day.
No, I just have known you folks or seen you folks for many years. I couldn't say it any better than Senator Gelzer, but did. That was perfect. Short, sweet, and very clear, very concise, and Senator Riley adding his part. I can give you a little bit of insight from what I went through, what I did in the town of Staten prior to being on council from 2007 until 2011 in Staten allowed me to be a part of a charter committee, getting input from the citizens, and then having the voter approval be part of our charter. Prior to that, I had to do referendums, which someone up here described what the process is to try to get signatures and get a referendum on the ballot. The people of Staten have made it clear for years through surveys and through other methods that they want to be able to vote on annexations. And when the question came up, did they want to vote on all annexations? They wanted to vote on all annexations. 1573 has completely usurped our rights and usurped our charter. Because of 1573, an annexation came through recently that we didn't get to vote on. Council passed it, and the citizens of Staten did not get to vote on that annexation. So the exact reason that 1573 should be repealed, and the exact reason that either Senate Bill 114 or 258 should be approved, recommended to pass, is very clear in my experience and what happened in Staten. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mr. Frank.
Good afternoon. My name is Steve Sear. I'm a retired architect. I live in currently live in Corvallis. I'm a property owner in Philomath, hopefully to be a Philomath resident soon. My wife Peggy and I are here today in support, vigorous support of the Senate bills 114 and 258 proposed to repeal the effects of the previous Senate Bill 1573 of 2016. We've discussed here, of course. The concept of how and when a small town should grow and what manner that should take place is important to me, having had background in construction for some 45 years or so as a profession in all sorts of project types, much of that time spent with residential work. Very important to understand and manage the growth process in order to get a refined, affordable, sustainable housing stock, essentially. It's important that the local control and the local voice is heard. My wife and I are concerned that the loss of that local control, the loss of the local control that's afforded by the established city charter in Philomath works against the concept of smarter, sustainable growth that is important to the state of Oregon at large, and I think to our environment in general. And so my third point today, to be brief, is essentially that we just urge in the strongest terms that the committee and the state legislature as a whole should support and pass this, either of the Senate bills, 114 or 258. I had heard the quote earlier today, I'd like to repeat it to finish, and that is, what touches all should be decided by all. And I want to thank you all for having this hearing today and allowing me to speak on this point. Thank you.
For coming up.
You bet.
Good afternoon, Chair and Deborah, members of the committee. For the record, Erin Doyle here on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I'm asking your support for either one of these bills. In cities, our charters are our constitutions, and while we don't always enjoy our elected officials feeling like they could be second-guessed by a vote, once that is the law of their land in their charter, that is the rules which they follow, and the expectation of the citizens is set thusly. There is one way to remove such a requirement, and is through the process of having it removed through the charter, which is through a vote of the citizens. That happened, for example, in Scappoose in 2015, after a significant number of elections in which after a period of time where people were hesitant to annex in Scappoose, the local government turned back to their citizens and said, do you really feel like we can't handle this decision-making anymore? Do you want it to continue to be voted on? And the voters overwhelmingly said, no, actually, the city council should be vested with this power. We agree through a vote to remove that from the charter, and that's the way this should be done. One of the big things is that there is no opportunity to be a no-growth city in this state. The urban growth boundary is set by law to require a 20-year land supply whether or not the community decides that it feels like growing. And UGBs that were set really, really early based on what happened in the 1970s and 80s, that really can't be amended, and that leads to the possibility of potentially doubling the number of houses in a very small community, which has a huge impact on budgets and finances. And for those reasons, we support repealing this so that our cities can go back to abiding by the charters which govern them. And I want to go back and answer Senator Roblin's question about how this 1573 works, whether it requires the city to annex or to amend the charter. What the bill did is, it actually is split on what it did. In a portion of the bill, it says the city shall annex if the certain requirements are left. And then at the other end, it says the city council may then annex. So it's actually divided within itself. It doesn't explicitly require the city to try to amend their charter, which is an authority we don't really have. Our charters are set by our voters. We can't just undo them, and we can't, and the Constitution is pretty clear on that, that when we get our home rule authority, it's from a power of the people telling us how their local governments will be run. But the bill itself is leads to the city taking a risk on interpreting those two differentiating words and attempt to avoid litigation in these issues. Happy to answer any further questions.
Questions, colleagues? I actually have one for you, Erin. So I know that a suit was brought on this issue of 1573, and in its first stage, the judge ruled that this is not a violation of the Constitution. Do you know, are there plans to appeal this decision?
Chair Dembro, it is my knowledge, the last I heard that we're still discussing it, but I believe the intention was to continue to raise the appeal. I'm just not certain the timing of all of that. So I believe it is the League's hope to continue that appeals process all the way up. I think one of the key distinctions is in looking at some of the charters, it's when the language of the voting requirement came in. Oftentimes they used the phrase notwithstanding state law to the contrary, which was related to the health and safety annexations, which we support. Well, those generally come into effect when there's a water impact of having people outside, and in order to connect them to the services, bringing them in through that health and safety annexation is very vital to protecting health and safety, thus the name. But oftentimes that was put in place before 1573, and so the voters would never have anticipated the state would come in and usurp the right in other conditions. So we'll be looking to continue that appeal.
Senator Roblin.
So do you know if any cities have gone the other direction? So a person petitions to have it in, they hear it, and then at the end they decide not to annex.
Chair Dembrow, Senator Roblin, I am not aware of a decision of a city council at this point to not annex under 1573's purview. We've actually seen most of a city council turn over because of one of these decisions when they decided to abide by the rules as written in 1573 as opposed to participating in the lawsuit. And I believe three or four of the city councilors were taken off, and they are now looking at their options of how to pay for the development, and they're not sure that they can.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Andy Shaw, do you want to come up? Is Dave Honeycutt here?
I think they're out there in the hallway.
They might be in our block group.
Yeah. Okay, Dave Honeycutt, if you are within earshot, please come. Andy, you want to start us off?
Absolutely. Andy Shaw with Metro. Chair Dembrow and committee members, thank you for the time today. We actually have a different perspective on this bill. Metro is a home rule charter, and we have a number of cities within Metro that are home rule charters, cities. We have about 23 cities within Metro. Last year, from our point of view, the legislature corrected a problem where local rules governing voting on annexation actually directly contradict our efforts to smartly manage growth in the region. We think this measure would reverse that progress, and we urge you to oppose the bill. As you know, the metro area has grown significantly over the past decade, and we forecast very strong growth coming forward. To prepare for this growth, our region's engaged in a very collaborative, ongoing process involving the public every time we do an urban growth cycle. We do a comprehensive review of the kind of growth that's coming, job growth, employment growth, and we look inside our urban growth boundary to see if we can handle all that growth. When we decide that we can't, we look outside the boundary, and we, if we are required to, we make an expansion of the boundary. We're relying on that land to provide capacity for housing and for jobs for future residents. We do this every 6 years, and in looking at where to add land, we look to the best places to add based on as a top line, preservation of farm and forest land, but also the places that cities are able to provide the streets, the pipes, the parks, the other kinds of infrastructure you've heard about up till now. But when we add that land to the boundary, that's really just the beginning of the process. A city needs to develop and adopt a plan, identify funding for roads, water, all those pieces of infrastructure, and they need to annex the land. We do all this work at the regional level and at the local level, involving the public very deeply all along the way. But these local policies on voting on annexation can sometimes overturn many, many years of work to identify places that we're going to grow and accommodate housing. As an example, in Oregon City, we added land in the early 2000s there. Metro provided funding to the city to do comprehensive planning there. The city developed a comp plan involving the public. They held public hearings, and they adopted that plan. They got consent of the landowners to annex. But three votes in a row narrowly rejected that annexation. But for this local voting policy, we would have housing in that area of East Oregon City today, providing a critical portion of supply of housing that we lack. We planned way ahead over the past number of decades to prepare for this growth, and we feel this policy that was mitigated last session, not removed, is a very important policy to retain. We urge you to oppose these bills and retain the policy. I would just remind you, this doesn't remove voting rights on annexation, but there's a slice of it that it does preempt, where it says if you've got a place that was planned, you've got a city that wants to add this land, you've got consent of all the landowners to do it, and you've got an adopted comp plan which has to go through a public process, then you override this local charter provision. We're in a tough position because we are a home rule charter government, so we absolutely respect the voters' rights and our local rights to operate under those home rule charters. But this is an example where the metro region goals and the state statute that you direct us to go and plan for out for 20 years of growth directly can conflict with these local voting processes. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Andy. Any questions for Mr. Shaw? Okay, thank you, Andy. Okay, let's have Robert Burns and Nathan Hightower, please.
ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for allowing us to say a few words here. My name is Bob Burns, Robert Burns. I live in Jefferson, just a few miles down the road. I was recently elected to the city council. The first time in my life I find myself being in a political office at the ripe old age of 73. Not something I really looked forward in my retirement, but I'm here principally because, I'm in my job principally because the people of my community were incensed at 1573 and our city council at the time to annex a piece of land which prior had been turned down in annexation by the citizens. When 1573 was passed and the governor signed it, the ink hadn't dried before a particular landowner applied for an annexation, and the city council, usually people that have been around for 15, 20 years, forthwith approved the annexation. That forced myself, three others, to circulate a petition for referendum, which we had enough signatures within two or three days. And we turned it into the city recorder, and the city recorder, who had 19 years on the job, refused to allow our referendum to go forward. We have since sued the city to allow that referendum to go through. I urge you in the strongest possible terms to give us our right to vote back. Our citizens want it back. And we are almost united, except for a small cadre of old-timers, as usual. We are united in our desire to not lose this right. So that's all I have to say, and thank you very much.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Hightower.
Yes, my name is Nathan Hightower, Jefferson, Oregon. I just want to also speak to Ms. Doyle's comment about the city that's going through that same thing. As Bob Burns has pointed out, City of Jefferson is that city. I'd like to tell you a little story. First of all, you have my testimony. I wanted to speak to both the City of Jefferson and the City of Corvallis, but I'll leave the City of Corvallis as a second story for your own to read. There cannot be more important effort to maintain the citizens' right to vote on an annexation than that of the City of Jefferson. It has created a terrible case of anarchy by a long-term landowner applicant and the majority of its voting citizens. Both the issue of LUBA criteria is in question, as well as the outcome of the decision of whether the city had the right not to or to not follow their city charter and pass an ordinance by legislation that is not referable to the citizens for vote. This town has been run by a coalition of people, as you've heard, of people for decades that are deep supporters of the applicant of the annexation, including the prior city council and mayor. You want to keep a bedroom community and want no others in control of that outcome. Currently, a very large demographic of the people are fixed-income families with both where both parents work and are very limited budgets. An increased tax burden for added infrastructure subtracts from their bottom line, where businesses could be brought in to share the growing tax burden. The city has neglected to do so. The citizens chose a vote, and the slate chose to vote in a slate of councilors, as I spoken to earlier, and a new mayor in order for that to change. They wanted to see businesses move into the city and share the tax burden versus the residents increasing their taxes, their property taxes, water bills, electric bills, and so on and so forth. Guess what I would say is this. Is that now these new city council members and mayor are on the city council and are decision makers for the city. This has caused the people backing the applicant to go crazy and rail at each city council meeting this year, and now are doing character assassinations of the newly elected members and councilors. The applicant is attempting to get one of them to resign, and in doing so, the applicant sees it as though a majority is lost and they can make a new decision and vote on the annexation application without any influence. The applicant knows this. The applicant has formulated a very ugly vocal campaign every other Thursday night to threaten each council member and mayor, and as well, each one is being bullied by social media as well as in each meeting. It's almost unbelievable. The newly elected council members, and I'll close here, and mayor feel very threatened. They are not sure how to proceed. Ethics violations have been filed, and threats for recall and resignations are heard at every turn. Now you guys know how this city might feel. But so now, a little city of 3,400 people is torn apart from this legislation. Not a thought was considered when it was ran through the Senate on an emergency basis. And now farmers, ranchers, citizens of the town are literally ripped apart. And I think the emergency is now for this little town. And so I would ask that you go forward with 114 and 258 immediately. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hightower.
Before they do, could I ask a question?
Yes, sorry.
would you mind if I asked you a question?
Of course.
Was the property that was annexed into the city, was that inside the urban growth boundary?
It was.
And so when the city decided to lay out their urban growth boundary, they said that we would like to have this piece in at some time.
That's way before my time, but the property was within the UGB and was subsequently annexed into the city, into the boundaries of the city. Yes.
Thank you. Okay, thank you both.
Thank you.
Okay, can I have Sid Friedan and Jennifer Sader? Sorry. Snyder, of course.
It's hard to read.
Yeah. And this will be our last panel on this bill, these bills. Sid, do you want to start?
Sure. Chair Denbrough Committee, Sid Friedman from Yamhill, Oregon. As a former county planning commissioner, who also served on both the McMinnville Urban Area Management Commission and the Newburgh Urban Area Management Commission, I want to voice my strong support for both bills for the reasons that you've eloquently heard from other speakers. Thank you.
Is it? Ms. Snyder.
Thank you. My name is Jennifer Snyder. I live in the urban growth boundary of Springfield, Lane County. And I appreciate your work today and having this hearing and being here to hear us. Thank you. I've been in Lane County over 30 years, having come from the very dense East Coast, and most of that time was spent in South Lane County. However, recently I moved into the urban growth area, seeking a larger home, a more appropriate home for my family, and we found a perfect place. I knew nothing about these issues. However, when a neighbor knocked on the door and was circulating a petition against an effort by Springfield or an interest by Springfield to annex our particular area, I learned a lot about it and saw a number of my neighbors on the petition, and I supported that in support of them. But I'm glad I did that, kind of not knowing a whole lot, because now it really made me think and pay more attention. What I've heard today, I'm especially concerned about the experience in Jefferson. I know some people who live there. I haven't been in touch with them for a long time. But that's exactly kind of the worst case scenario. When citizens in Oregon, I mean, we have this wonderful home rule thing that has been talked about, and it's real, and we have to protect our environment. We know that, increasingly we know that, but we also have to protect our communities, and I think it really comes down to when, because I see development happening within a mile of me, when developers come in and their sole purpose is to make money and to build something that will make other people more money, those of us who are going to be the community they live in have to be involved in that process, because it's the people who will be living there who will be living with us. And if we can't build our communities well, then we are at risk of descending into a make-believe chaos that's not our making. Thank you. Appreciate the extra time.
No, that's fine.
I have one question.
Yes, Vice Chair.
I like your expertise in planning. Thank you very much for that. A question is, if the urban growth boundary is established and you are not per se in the city limits but inside the urban growth boundary, it limits what you can do with your property. Is that correct?
Chair Denbrough, Senator Olson, the land that's between the city limits and the urban growth boundary is urbanizable land. That's a long-term, generally 20-year supply of land. The shorter-term supply of land and the decision to bring land in to be part of that shorter-term supply has to be based on infrastructure concerns, availability of services, ability to fund those services, and that's a decision that is a shorter-term decision than the longer-term decision for establishing a UGB. So yes, while it's true once you're in the urban growth boundary, there is the expectation that that land will come into the city limits and develop at urban densities at some point. The actual timing of that decision is a different matter.
I'll follow up.
Follow up.
When cities plan their urban growth boundaries, don't they look at what their capacities are in sewer and water prior to that determination for the UGB to see what they need in the future, and they lay it out for 20 or 30 years?
They do come up with capital with facilities plans, and you know, that cover things like water and sewer. Often those plans aren't funded, and often the ability to recover the cost of providing those services through SDCs, systems development charges, is very limited. Very few cities charge full freight SDCs. No city can charge SDCs for things like school, police, fire. They're not allowed to by law. So
hang on right there 1 second. There is a systems development charge for schools. It's about $1.27 a square foot.
Okay, I stand corrected then. But for police and fire, they cannot. You know, in my experience, when somebody approaches the city council and says, would you like to expand the territory under your control, the answer is almost an automatic yes. And maybe that's just human nature. When you're asked to control more, you generally say yes. But that decision is often made without sufficient consideration for the taxpayers in the city who are ultimately going to have to bear some of the cost of funding that new development.
Okay, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
So before I close this hearing, I want to thank everyone who came to be heard. You know, I'm sorry that last year during the 2016 session, the timing was such that that wasn't allowed to happen. I really appreciated how clearly and forcefully the arguments were made today. And I think it's given us all a lot to think about. You know, I will say in all candor, I think it's a lot to expect that a deal that was reached just a year ago is going to be undone quite so quickly. But, you know, I think you've given us a lot to chew on, and I really appreciate that. So with that, I'm going to close our public hearings on Senate Bills 114 and 258. And I'm going to open our hearing on Senate Bill 418. We're really lucky that it's the next one up in numerical terms, because we have the fewest number of people signed up to speak to it. And we can get through it very quickly. It's my pleasure to invite up Senator Beyer.
I thought he was coming down to defend himself.
Senator Beyer.
That was all about him. I don't know why.
Yes.
Should have been here 30 minutes.
You're the man of the hour. Now you're the man of Senate Bill 418.
I am. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, for the record, Lee Beyer, State Senator from Senate District 6 in the Center Valley. What 418 is all about is it's a continuation of a project that I actually worked on in 2013, 2014 with Richard Whitman when he was then not doing DEQ, but was the governor's natural resource amendment. A lot of this stuff went forward, but from my perspective, what we were trying to do is recognize the land use planning system is very strong, very good, but occasionally we need to streamline it a little bit to make sure that it doesn't cost cities, and it's mostly cities, an arm and a leg to go through the process to upgrade their land use plans. What this bill, Senate 418, does specifically is it actually takes one step farther on what was adopted as periodic review. And what it essentially says is that there are about five or six steps, elements of a land use of a UGB expansion that are required before it can be acknowledged or accepted, approved by DLCD or the commission. And in that process, each one of those steps, you know, what we're trying to say is that in periodic review, each step can be approved individually by the director, and once approved, it can be challenged. Everybody has full legal rights to challenge it, but once you get beyond that challenge or that challenge period, if no one challenges it, then it can't be challenged later on. The problem in a lot of things has been that cities, when they're doing a UGB expansion, will get all the way to the end, and then a challenge will come on the very first element, and a lot of times that means you got to do the whole thing over again. So rather than doing that, what makes logical sense to me is, as you're doing periodic review, is say if a city is initiating a UGB expansion, that it do the required elements, meet all of the legal conditions, but at each stage, optionally for them, they don't have to under the law, but they can submit that for approval individually, each step as a building block to getting the full wall or the full UGB. And that's the essence of the plan. I know I've met with DLCD staff, and they have told me that what you're seeing more of is, because we changed periodic review, is hardly anybody is going through periodic review anymore. They're individually going through these UGB expansions, because that's the more logical way to do it given today. And again, that differs with the size of the jurisdiction. We specifically changed the process for those under 25,000, but the larger ones. And I, frankly, on part of this stuff, I know from personal experience, community where I live, they were approved, I believe it's in 2007, an opportunity to redo their UGB boundary, both Eugene and Springfield, under what was considered then to be an expedited process. That expedited process is still underway. I think Springfield's just in the process now of getting theirs, and Eugene's not quite there. And I know that in my community, because I sat on the Planning Commission in the early 2000s when I left the legislature, it's cost them in the millions to process that. And in my mind, in terms of some of that, is we've got to do a better job. We ought to be able to make our land use planning process work for less cost. Because you start looking at millions, that's an awful lot of police and fire officers and tight budgets. So I'm trying to do the simple things without giving anything away that kind of adds a little more logical process while still making sure everybody has a thing. I think you'll hear from the cities that LCDC says they could just do a periodic review. I think that's going to be their response. That just is not an easy way to do it. And that's just not the way most cities are doing it now. And we've heard lots of things. I mean, you could go to, you know, Ben, Senator Knope was telling me at lunch today that they were into their process over there, something like $11 million to process a change. That's a lot of money. And we ought to be able to do the same thing, protecting our lands and having logical, reasonable processes to move forward while still providing everybody the protection of being able to challenge something that they think's wrong. So that's the essence of the bill. It's not very complicated. It builds on what we have, the recent changes we've made, and I think makes a lot of sense. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes. Vice Chair Olson.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Beyer, for bringing this forward. Could you give me a brief, maybe just a little description of what this bill, how it would work, like if the city is going to take in 1,000 acres, are you talking about they're doing it incrementally, like 300 at a time?
No. This would be on, they're proposing they want to take in 1,000 acres, so they have to justify that. They have to justify it, and is there a population change? Was there a, you have to do the residential industrial lands analysis. There are standardized process steps that are established through either statute or OAR that you have to go through, and they're sequential, usually. I mean, the whole driver, frankly, the whole driver on whether you can do an expansion or not is based on your population projection. I think it was 2013 we changed that. That used to be a very controversial issue in terms of what's the right population. We changed that law to allow cities voluntarily to just accept a projection that was done by the population center. If they accepted that, it was beyond challenge. After you get about that, you're going to have to do an analysis of the land. Do you really need it? The point is, have you used it? Do you really need it or not? And for what, housing or industrial? So there's sort of some logical steps there. Once a plan is acknowledged, it's up to the director of DLCD to approve that, to say that they've addressed the goals correctly and it's a justified expansion.
Predicated on our previous discussions on the last two bills, Wouldn't this be an ideal time for citizens to step up and say whether they agree with this expansion or not?
Well, I think you're getting back. I'm guessing what you just heard. I didn't hear it.
Mm-hmm.
I've always thought if the citizens or want to object, they need to get involved in the planning process, whether that's the periodic review or UGB. That's the time to object. Or if a community wanted to put it to a vote of their citizens, the time to do it would be when you're making a plan change rather than on an individual application.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Certainly have the right to do that.
Yes. I just want to remind you, Senator, this is the Natural Resources Committee, and so 10 years is not that long a time. We think in terms of geological time here. So.
But $1 million is still $1 million.
Thank you.
It's more than $1 million when you have to do it 20 years, twice.
Yeah.
If you're on a 10-year cycle, it's more than $1 million.
Well, it could be a lot of money. If you've ever been involved in land use changes, it's a lot of money. I know Senator
yes,
Olson is well aware of that. There's nothing cheap when you're doing development.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you very
Senator
much.
Meyer.
Thank you
for
your
consideration.
Bringing
it forward, of course. So I'm going to bring up Aaron Doyle and Mary Kyle McCurdy at the same time, please. And may the best woman win. The better woman.
Erin tells me you've been keeping her very busy today with legislation, so she'd like a few moments to collect her thoughts. Mary Kyle McCurdy, Chair Dembro, and members of the committee representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. We are opposed to Senate Bill 418 really because we think it's not necessary any longer. And I've been through the processes that Senator Beyer described and recall those conversations about trying to fix or make it go faster, the urban growth boundary expansion and evaluation process. And those have been addressed in several ways. One is by having Portland State conduct the population projections for all cities and counties. And the other, and this was a solution that was developed by Richard Whitman to address the problem that Senator Beyer described, which is the streamlined Goal 14 process, which is an alternative process that any city can use to go through the urban growth boundary evaluation and expansion process. So there's two paths now, the streamlined process or the process that a city can go through, the old-fashioned one. And that really was determined to be a better way than the sequential urban growth boundary process. But as you've heard, if a city chooses to go through periodic review, it can structure its periodic review in the steps that are described in this bill through the sequential process. And in the discussions about the concepts behind this bill back a few years ago, there were just some stumbling blocks that, frankly, cities as well as participants in those processes raised that felt that we all felt were better addressed through the streamlined process, and that this legislature directed DLCD to come up with a streamlined process, and it was a very diverse and thorough group that met to come up with that new Goal 14 process of cities, counties, many state agencies, and we met about every 2 weeks for months and months to come up with that process. So we have two processes now through periodic review, through the streamlined process, and through the regular Goal 14 process. That's actually three processes. I think adding another one would add to confusion and isn't necessary any longer. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembro, members of the committee. Again, Aaron Doyle on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. I think Senator Beyer said it best when he was talking about the UGBs, about this being an expensive, complicated, and difficult process. When we look at how we do our urban growth boundary expansions, prior to that stakeholder effort that Mary Kyle just referred to create this secondary, we call it the streamlined UGB process that did pass in 2013, we did look at how expensive and long it took, and it very much depended upon the size of the UGB, the size of the city, and the number of people in the community that wanted to participate. And so we have some cities that have been able to effectively expand their UGB in a relatively short period of time, and others that have taken a decade and millions of dollars And those are, of course, the ones that receive the largest amount of attention because they highlight where some of those hang-ups have been. 2013 tried to create one more tool to that legislation in 2013 has created one more path that we can move forward. But referring to periodic review as an opportunity is really it's very difficult to say that the opportunity is there because cities aren't going into periodic review because it is complicated, expensive, and the department doesn't necessarily have the resources to provide the support that our cities have needed. In the interim between last session and this, one of the things I kind of wanted to look at are what are the big picture issues in the land use system that need some sort of modification, and periodic review is the one that jumped out at me as the next big issue that we needed to address. Because while it is true that there is a requirement that DLCD and LCDC set up a schedule for all cities over 10,000 to do a periodic review every 10 years, we don't even get through a periodic review in 10 years. There just aren't the resources there to get it done. So this bill creates an interesting opportunity where we could revitalize periodic review when the goal is urban growth boundary expansion, instead of just doing a timely review as set by a schedule that hasn't really been followed. So periodic review, I think, needs to be examined. I think that's a conversation that's very much worth having. I think this bill as a concept might be able to direct us in that look back at periodic review to see what we need to do to actually make sure that it occurs. Because one of the things that many of my planners have talked about is the difficulty in determining what needs updating and how to get that update done. And that many of them would like to maybe pull those older UGBs off the shelf. Maybe some of those UGBs that have become an issue in the prior discussion might be about as old as the land use system itself. And there needs to be an opportunity to reexamine what our expectations were and how we have or have not met them. Because I think at the beginning of the land use system, it's been thrown out there that we were pretty greedy in our UGBs. We set really big UGBs that haven't been able to been eaten up. But in other areas, it very much has been. And for those cities that are seeing that rapid population growth that need to do something faster than 10 to 15, 7 years to accomplish an urban growth boundary expansion, maybe having another tool or maybe fixing the tool that exists in periodic review would be the best way for them moving forward so that they can, instead of having to do all of the work and then hope it doesn't get appealed, can instead kind of hit one work product, run that through the gamut, make sure it's sound, and then go back through on a rapid timeline to let that city know that once we get to our final decision, all of the foundation work is good to go, and we're not going to be brought back on an appeal based on where we were in step two, because now step one population forecast is not a land use decision that can be appealed. But we want to be able to not have to go back to re-examine step two when we're at step 10 of finalizing that urban growth boundary. And if there's a way to get to that system where we can be comfortable in our foundations, be comfortable in our factual findings, know that our decision makings and our findings are already been tested and proofed, and then we're going to get that UGB at the end of this cycle. So for those reasons, I think this is a good start of a positive idea and maybe leads us to a better conversation about periodic review. Thank you.
Any questions? So my sense is that, Mary Collin, your opposition is primarily because it's not needed. Would it hurt things to pass this? Aaron's suggesting that maybe it's not really needed either, but it would create a conversation of some sort or a different frame for future work.
Chair Denbrough and members of the committee, I think I don't think that this bill is necessary tied to urban growth boundary expansions only. I think what Aaron has described is accurate, that we have, because of the lack of funding, periodic review, which is not necessarily something that should be done just because someone's city's thinking about an urban growth boundary expansion. Periodic review is a review of an entire plan, but these two get tied together. So what we have, for example, are many cities with outdated plans on their housing need analysis, and they may have housing zoning for housing inside their urban growth boundary that really no longer bears resemblance to the future needs of their of those who live in there. And if at the only time we're looking at the housing needs analysis and buildable lands inventory is when a UGB expansion might be considered, you're just tying it up in a longer process, in a contentious process. And most cities aren't expanding their urban growth boundaries, actually, would be my guess. So there's a staleness to plans that develops because we're not doing the periodic review. And I think that is a larger issue. So it's not a really, we need a discussion about it. Maybe that's a direction to the department for a direction for the department that we can work on.
Great. Senator Brzezinski.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, based on your question and the response and based on what we just heard in the last two bills, I'm wondering if it wouldn't be better to maybe have this as the starting point of a discussion that we have between now and next short session to figure out, is it appropriate, necessary, reasonable, and all that, because it just seems like if we throw something else out there, there's some conflict as to what will or won't, and if it's confusion, it just seems to me that, you know, these things get very sensitive to communities, and I would suggest that we make certain we know what we're doing before we have someone coming in 2018 saying, you know, that bill that was y'all had the last time?
Thank you for that advice.
That's just a quick one.
Just because it ties to the other one that we had just before. So this is a process where people can truly get involved in their communities about how to expand. Either one that we do, whether it's the new one here or the revision of the old one, way the new one, or the other process that women did. Is that the place we should have the conversation as opposed to the two other bills, which say you can have all the conversations you want, you can have all the discussion about how to build out, but by golly, before you can do any of it, you've got to have another election?
Chair Dembro, Senator Roblin, I think I can address this. I think that the public process has to occur all the way through. I think that we can't say... And part of this is because when you're looking at an urban growth boundary expansion, you're not dealing with the citizens within the city alone, and it's harder to find out and figure out where you're going to do that public outreach, because your urban growth boundary decision is where are we going to expand is kind of towards the end of that discussion, and so folks won't necessarily know to get involved until their plots are being looked at, which might raise their concern. I think that the citizens within the city should always be engaged in the land use process, but given the way some of my colleagues react within our offices alone, people hear land use and get a little bit intimidated. Voting on an urban growth boundary or a comprehensive plan has also proven to be the downfall, literally, of one of our cities, which was very difficult for that community, and that level of direct democracy can create its own version of problems. But I think that even as we go through the process of once we have that urban growth boundary decision made, that urban growth boundary is supposed to be a setup for 20 years of expansion, and a community can have a drastic change in personality and expectations within those 20 years. I mean, look at Bend as one of those examples of a city that, you know, was a smaller Central Oregon town, you know, going about at the same rate, and all of a sudden something happened, someone tasted the water out there and realized this is a great place to live and started telling their friends and their families, and they all started moving out there. And all of a sudden, Bend was looking at what had been a sufficient 20-year supply and trying to do an urban growth boundary expansion and running into all kinds of engagement from all kinds of cities, of citizens, people who didn't want infill, people who want infill, people who wanted to go west, north, south, east, and that has led to a really long and complicated process. I think the community involvement that we saw after it was sent back on appeal that was much more mediated. I think that the city worked very hard to make sure that public process was enough that they could get something done, but they definitely don't feel that they've done enough. And because they changed so drastically in that time period, it's very difficult for the decision that was made originally to really necessarily be the same conversation that you're going to have, you know, 20 years out when you're looking to finally annex a property. And the annexation question gets kicked around a lot. I know that when you were chair, we had an annexation 101, and we talked about the finance issues. We talked about voting. We talked about how this has interaction with special districts. And all of these things are very complicated, and it's not always the most robust public commentary because people don't know to show up until it suddenly impacts them, because it's the neighbor, it's the parks provider, it's their tax dollars, because a lot of this development, while we charge charges, doesn't cover the cost to provide all of the services.
Aaron, I think I'm going to ask
I just realized it was on the
We don't have time for
a
101.
So,
but
I do think the public process is important, but it should take place all the way through.
Great. Okay. Thank you both.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And we will consider this bill. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 418 and open up a public hearing. Our last public hearing, Senate Bill 1036. And I'm going to ask Willie Tiffany and is it Jan Sinclair? Jen Stuber, sorry.
Sorry for my
yeah. And as you're coming up, Beth, can you remind us what this bill is?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1036 would revise the statutory definition of surface mining to exempt from Dungami permitting requirements the excavation and movement of materials at a landfill that's permitted by DEQ.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. With me today, I brought technical expert Jennifer Stuber as the regional manager for Republic Services. Republic Services manages, she actually manages the Coffin Butte landfill down in Corvallis on behalf of Republic Services, so she's here to answer any questions you might have. Senate Bill 1036, we asked the committee to introduce the bill on our behalf. We appreciate that, both Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair. We're trying to address an issue that recently came to our attention. In our research, the definition of surface mining was first adopted in the state of Oregon in 1971, and then along with that came the permitting requirements under the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, otherwise known as DOGAMI. DOGAMI testimony, which you have received, pretty well lays out what those requirements are and what the definition is. But for the record, just for our discussion here, a layman's definition of surface mining is moving 5,000 cubic yards of material in a one-acre parcel in a 12-month period. That's a pretty low standard for certain activities. Over the years, a number of exemptions, because of that low standard, come before this body. Things like farm use, building public roads, certain waterway activities, and others. Landfills in Oregon are heavily regulated, but regulated under the solid waste system. The solid waste statutes are as 459 for environmental purposes and other purposes. And in those requirements are certain earth-moving activities, such as daily cover, maintaining access roads, maintaining cells, and other types of facilities. This bill basically tries to address those three topics. While these activities technically meet that definition of surface mining, the DOGAMI has never really required or considered that those activities were mining for commercial purposes and therefore never required any sort of permit fee or permit requirement for landfills. That changed in 2014, so that's why it recently came to our attention, where an interpretation came to light that actually certain activities like moving daily cover, again, cell maintenance and access road maintenance actually do meet that definition. So it's also our understanding that DOGAMI still, even though that they technically meet that definition, DOGAMI still doesn't consider those commercial mining activities. However, they're in this bind where they now are in the process of maybe having to require regulation, and in certainly one case they have required that regulation. So what we're trying to do here in Senate Bill 1036 is provide a very narrow exemption for those very specific permitted activities that are non-commercial, again, non-commercial, and they're activities that remain on site. So we're not importing material for these activities or trying to use commercial activities associated with these three different practices. Now, I will say aggregate extraction at landfills does occur pretty regularly, and those are heavily permitted through Dugami. Usually our members, and Jen can talk about Coffin Butte specifically, but we would typically subcontract that out to a typical aggregate extraction company. They would go through the process, and then when it comes time for the landfill activity to start, we would come in under DEQ regulation and continue those regulations. We worked hard with Dugami, with OCAPA, with AOC, and anyone else we could find on these provisions. We think they're sufficiently narrow. I think you'll hear today some testimony in opposition probably with respect to the Riverbend landfill situation. This bill definitely was not introduced with the intention of affecting Riverbend in any way. In fact, the ORA members that brought this to our attention are from Medford, Corvallis, Arlington, Boardman, other parts of the state. In fact, Riverbend is the only landfill that does meet the and has a Dugami permit, so it really doesn't apply to them. And that wasn't the purpose for the introduction of this bill. So with that, Mr. Chair, tried to be brief and again have a technical expert here if you have any questions about the activities that occur at a landfill. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions, colleagues? Again, you know, I think our goal here was a very modest goal,
right,
and a very just to address those issues that you had raised. We have a lot of people who are signed up to speak against it. Let's hear what some of their arguments are. If you all could stick around,
and
in case we need you to answer them.
Great, thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. We have a couple of other proponents. Let's hear from them first. Mike Dewey and Mark Nystrom. Are you here, Mark? Well, there he is. Okay, Mike.
Thank you. I'll be brief. Mike Dewey, Mr. Chair, on behalf of Waste Management. Waste Management owns and operates the Riverbend landfill. And as the previous testimony provided to you, the opponents of Riverbend, and I'll be brief, the opponents here today would like to close the landfill. And they are using every opportunity that they can, and they should. And unfortunately, they got an adverse Court of Appeals decision a couple weeks ago, and they are running out of options in order to do that. This is a local issue. This is a DEQ issue. It's not essentially a Dugami issue. But this bill has nothing to do with the operation of Riverbend Landfill. As a matter of fact, in terms of where we're going in on an expansion, we have a hearing on May 2nd. It was just announced today by DEQ to discuss the final grading for the berm, which is a temporary way of providing capacity to the landfill. And that record stays open until May 8th. You're going to hear a lot of complaints about Riverbend Landfill. DEQ has heard those. The county has heard those. We've had odor issues from time to time, bird issues. We mitigate that. But this is not the forum here today. We have the Dugami permit. So by virtue of passing this law or not, it doesn't affect us. Every issue that has come before the county, this is Yamhill County, has approved either the extension of the landfill or the land use compatibility statement. And those have always been litigated. And we're getting very close to having that litigation final. So I just wanted to point out that you're going to hear a number of things. That's been on the record at DEQ for a number of years or at the county. And most of that has been asked in answer. So I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mike. Mark.
Chair Dunbrough, members of the committee, I'm Mark Nystrom. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties here to testify in support of the bill. We also submitted -1 amendments that would include the excavation or grading operations necessary for the construction and maintenance of utilities, drainage facilities, irrigation facilities. Our county public works folks have occasionally been concerned about those being considered also a mining operation. Talking to Rich Angstrom from OCAPA, he asked us to add if the material, excavated material, is used on site and not sold to the commercial market as aggregate materials, we're fine with that. So we'd like you to consider the dash one amendments as well. Thank you.
And again, just to understand what you're trying to do, it's moving things around.
Right, right. If you're digging a trench or a ditch that needs to be there, that's not a commercial mining operation. And we, in the way that the bill is written, you have to write the exceptions rather than the bill doesn't say what you should be doing. It just accepts certain things.
Okay. Senator Przanski.
I don't see the dash ones posted.
Senator, they're not because they're going to request an additional amendment. So.
I read them, though. It's a one.
I'm glad you did.
Yeah.
I'd like to be able to look at them, too.
Yeah.
Senator Robles.
So is this like irrigation ditches as well, cleaning them out?
Yeah.
As long as the material stays on the line, it wouldn't have to be a DECOMI permit?
Right. We were just concerned with, if you're building a new irrigation ditch or if you had to put some sort of other utility or drainage ditch, we were just looking for ways of having to accept, you know, that might be used and need to be accepted from that commercial mining.
This is your old bill. All right, thank you both.
Thank you.
Great. Okay. Let's have William Orr, Ilsa Purse, and Leo Crick, please. Just calling people up in order that they signed up.
They leave me alone.
Okay. Hey, Mr. Orr.
My name is William Orr. I'm a registered professional geologist with the state of Oregon and Washington, and have been so since 1978, and I live in Marion County. I'm opposed for professional reasons to any changes to the Riverbend landfill, but specifically the issue here is that to remove Jet Dogami, as I understand it, from an oversight position. The problems there are not only moving dirt. You're right next to the river, so you have some hydrology problems, which they may or may not be aware of. There are also pollution problems and so forth. But you've got some very talented, you've got a suite of very talented geologists working for Dogami who recognize those kind of problems. And I don't understand why you would remove that safety valve. That's kind of beyond me. In any case, I dealt with issues kind of like this. I served for two terms on the State Board of Geologic Examiners and one term at the pleasure of the governor as the chair of that board. And a lot of times the problems that were serious were not even recognized if there had not been a geologist there. So I see no reason to change this and take away that particular oversight. It's kind of a safety issue.
Okay, thank you. Ilsa?
Hello, my name is Ilsa Purse. I live on Mineral Springs Road outside Carlton. I work with Stop the Dump Coalition, which Mr. Dewey has alluded to. Thank you for the opportunity to speak on this bill. Mr. Dewey made the point that DEQ is in charge and therefore we really shouldn't be worrying about much of anything because DEQ does such does a good job of overseeing the problems at the landfill. And I would like you to know that we have watched for a decade now as DEQ has been unable to solve multitudes of problems at the landfill. And there are, you know, the bird problem, the smell problem, the six times the allowable amounts of E. coli going into the creeks. The list is pretty long of what has gone wrong at Riverbend Landfill. And I appreciate that there are probably many landfills in the state of Oregon for which this Dogami oversight might not be necessary. But if you pass 1036, Riverbend will be in the group of the landfills that don't have the need for oversight. And Riverbend has a great deal of need for oversight. It is in an extremely sensitive area. It is a severe seismic hazard zone. It sits on a river. It is in a floodplain. There are a multitude of problems. Allowing them to mine, should they be allowed to expand, somewhere close to 750,000 cubic yards to 1 million cubic yards of dirt on their own land means they'll be mining from places that are very sensitive. Without oversight, there is no real, there will be no one watching how they manage their land. They've already created a multiple million ton pile of garbage that will be there forever to then ruin all the land around it in order for them to have free dirt for all their works seems to be short-sighted. I urge you to vote no on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Crick.
Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today on this bill.
Mr. Crick, you don't have to be that close to the, it's very sensitive. You can just sit back and pay.
Thank you.
Yes.
My name is Leo Crick. I am a resident of Yamhill County and one of the directors of the Yamhill County Soil and Water District. Today I'm here to testify on the district's behalf. Our conservation district opposes Senate Bill 1036. We anticipate very serious consequences if this legislative change is approved. The proposed change in the definition of surface mining essentially eliminates the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries' ability to regulate fill and removal surface mining and earth-moving activities in wetlands and other sensitive areas operated as landfills. The state has an entrusted responsibility to protect natural resources, water resources, and provide oversight of fill and removal activities and mining operations. This is accomplished through DGAMI's review and approval of operations reclamation plan. A reclamation plan must provide written information such as measures to protect natural resources, minimize erosion, sedimentation, and pollution, and measures for site rehabilitation. DGAMI's review and approval of a required reclamation plan is a vital safeguard that needs to be retained. The proposed legislation will allow landfills to forego this requirement and conduct removal activities without DGAMI input and approval and without meeting permit requirements of the State of Department of State Lands. In Yamhill County, the proposed legislative change would that clearly applies to Riverville landfill operation located adjacent to the South Yamhill River and floodplain to remove fill from any area located within the boundaries of a landfill without addressing critical issues such as the following: impacts to removal activities to adjacent wetlands and stream channels, impacts to stream channel stability and potential for channel migration, likelihood of stream channel migration and the impact of to existing landfill stability structures, soil and quality impacts and ability of soils to filter contaminants to protect water quality, impacts to adjacent landowners, fish, and wildlife, and impacts to threatened endangered species protected under federal law.
Okay, the proposed... Mr. Crick, we need you to wrap up.
I got just one more paragraph. Thank you, sir. The proposed legislation is bad for Oregon and its natural resources. If approved, it would eliminate the process specifically established in law to protect natural resources and to provide assurances that sites have reasonable reclamation plans. Thank you for the opportunity to comment, and we appreciate your no vote on this Senate Bill 1036. Thank you.
Any questions of this group? Thank you very much. Ian, I'm going to ask you to come up, even though you didn't sign up. It's always a mistake to show up.
No.
I appreciate it.
Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ian Maiden. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries, and since January 1 of this year, I have been managing the Mineral Land Regulation and Reclamation Program.
Ian, can you say something about the history of DGAMI's work in this area? I mean, to what extent has DGAMI been engaged in these kind of daily activities in landfills?
So I'll give you my best understanding of this, again, given that I have very short personal history with this, but it is my understanding that until 2007, construction projects were specifically exempted from the requirement to get an operating permit as surface mining operations. As you will notice in the testimony that I provided, the definition of surface mining is very broad. Essentially, anyone who digs up the appropriate amount of quantity of material of any type for commercial, industrial, or construction uses is doing surface mining. And so landfills fall within that very broad definition. But until 2007, construction projects were exempt. That was changed. That exemption was removed in 2007. And it is my understanding that community was not informed, nor was the Dagami staff informed of that change until it was brought to our attention in 2014 with regard to the Riverbend landfill. And it was pointed out by some of the opponents of the landfill that they did in fact need a permit. And then at that point, we started going through the process to have a permit put in place for Riverbend landfill. And I cannot explain why there was a six-year period during which we did not act on that.
Mm-hmm. You probably don't know why that requirement was put in place back in 2007. Do you understand that
there was concern by the aggregate industry that there was some clandestine aggregate mining going on under the guise of construction, or in instances it was actually a construction project, but they were, in fact, selling some of the material that they were excavating off-site and competing, therefore, with other aggregate mines without going through the same permitting process. And so this change was an effort to sort of address that impact on the market and level the playing field.
We heard concern, I think, that if Dagami were not involved, it would just be up to DEQ to be overseeing these operations. And from your perspective, what expertise would be missing if it were left up to DEQ in terms of, you know, wetlands, proximity to water, et cetera?
Certainly. Our mine land reclamation program has a grand total of 11 positions, only 8 of which are filled, only 4 of which are technical. There is virtually no aspect of landfill management that we have even remotely the same amount of expertise as DEQ has. Our permit for the Riverbend landfill has no reclamation plan because the law allows us to waive the reclamation plan, because the assumption is that reclamation of that landfill site is covered in the closure plan that was developed in concert with DEQ and is overseen by DEQ. Our permit with the Riverbend landfill has no conditions. Typically, we have conditions like no off-site impacts and a variety of other sort of boilerplate. That is not in this particular permit. My interpretation, again, not having been involved in actually writing and issuing this permit, is that it's kind of a pro forma permit and does not actually add any oversight or regulation as to the operations or the offsite impacts of that ongoing activities at the landfill.
Thanks, Ian. Anybody have any questions for Ian? Okay, thank you for that background, Ian. You're going to feel like you've been in this job for years pretty soon, I think. Okay, colleagues, we have 2 more panels of 3, and, if you have to leave, feel free, but I want to hear them. Sheila Alfson, Ramsey McPhillips, and Leonard Kufel?
Rydell.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Sheila, you want to begin?
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Sheila Alfson, and I am a longtime resident of Yamhill County, and I am also a geologist. And I teach classes at Portland State University on river erosion and river processes. So I just want to start with a little story. This is a geology lesson, okay? You said you like geologic time. Here we go. In 1964, the Army Corps of Engineers built a retaining wall inside the Sandy River and the upper reaches of the Sandy River, and that was to protect homes that were along the bank. River erosion was happening. In the beginning of this decade, the river changed its course during a flood event, and the river is now closer to the homes than it ever was. It's eroding the bank. The very wall that they built to retain and protect those homes is now preventing the river from going back into its original channel. So why am I saying this? The point is engineering doesn't always work. And in the end, the river is going to win out. The geology needs to be considered. Riverbend Landfill is located in a very poor place geologically as far as the groundwater goes. As far as the seismic hazard, I can't even begin to tell you what a nightmare that will be. But as far as river erosion goes, so in 2012, I attended some public lectures on this situation and did a preliminary survey of the area and found out that if they take the soil from the place that they want to take it, it will triple the gradient of the river in that area. That will, simply put, that will make the river go faster. It'll make its erosive power greater. And so for that reason, I oppose it. I'm not opposing this as a landowner. I'm opposing this as a geologist. I think that it's a hazard. And it's a hazard. It's a disaster in waiting is what I feel. And I urge you to oppose it.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Sheila. Mr. McPhillips.
Ramsey McPhillips. I'm a Willamette Valley farmer who lives adjacent to Riverbend Landfill. Thank you, committee, for listening to my testimony. I'm going to change what I was going to say to get in the weeds a little bit regarding to what Mr. Dewey testified. One, the permit of Dogami that he states is overlaying the Riverbend Landfill was placed there when the landfill was a PWS zoning. They have since changed the zoning to EFU, which, in fact, brings in all of the land use statutes under 459, and therefore things have changed since that Dogami permit. If you enact this, remove this overlay, as they go forward with their expansion, they're going to have to redo the permits, and that Dogami permit will be re-evaluated and not part of their expansion. Number two, he said that we have lost. Well, they also lost at the Court of Appeals. This has been going on and on and on, and we are still in county warfare for 9 years now. He has not moved on to DEQ. What he referred to as DEQ is just a minor permit that they want to add to the existing landfill to buy some time to fight people such as myself. So I hope you will consider Mr. Dewey as a paid lobbyist advocating as well he should for his business, but I would check into the weeds before you assume what he's saying is pertinent to actually what is happening at Riverbend Landfill today. So if I have a few seconds left, I'm the actual farmer. You're the Natural Resource and Environment Committee. I would love for you to come and visit my farm and see what we're talking about, because I share the basin with the landfill. So what affects at the landfill, any removal of soil, is going to affect my property. I literally share the basin. So lastly, now that the landfill has changed its zoning and is party to the actual farming regulations having to do with landfills, when the landfill closes, they are going to have to return the landfill to farming. That's the statute. It's 459.055, right? So where are they going to get the soil to cover the landfill presently, but from the farmland that they're then going to have to rehabilitate? So it doesn't make sense for them to be given the opportunity to use all this ancillary land that they have bought to cover Portland's trash, when in the end they're going to have to use that land to return to comparable farming. Lastly, just if you, one quick thing. The excavation community takes their soils contaminated to the landfill under a greatly reduced rate. It's called beneficial use, because the landfill has a need for soil to cover in daily and final cover and to build these roads. So if you pass this law and Riverbend it starts to get all of its soil on site, they no longer will have the need to discount soil that is brought in from all of the things such as giant earthworks, all the contaminated soil, oil tanks that are taken out. That symbiotic relationship, which is very loved by the excavation community, goes out the bridge. In fact, Metro said that if this law changes, that the $30 that is discounted in the Metro region for these beneficial use soils will go away, and perhaps they will be charged $30 extra per ton to deliver garbage into Riverbend landfill. Please take those into considerations.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Mr. Ryder.
It's Rydell. I'm Leonard Rydell. I'm a civil engineer. I used to be engineer of the record for the landfill, so I know where all the secrets are. And I'm planning on writing a book on what I've learned. I wrote a letter. I hope you take the time to do it. It's got pictures in it. It should be entertaining. It should make the point pretty well that the DEQ is pretty ineffective. And they'll take pictures of it, say it doesn't meet the standards, and that nothing happens. I'm concerned that we're putting the DEQ in charge of something, and they don't have any standards. I have a copy of the permit. I would mail you a CD of it, of the Dogami permit. There's no reclamation plan in there. There's nothing about harvesting it for dirt. They're filling a road, building a 30, 40-foot high road across the wetland to access the property where they took it, evicted 77 mobile home park places. But in the permit to the Division of State Lands, they don't mention why they need it. The Division of State Lands ask, why do you need the road? And they say, well, we just kind of need it, you know. So a lot of stuff happens at River Bend because of that. The permit engineer that overlooks this is 100 miles away. He comes once a month. I point out things that I covered in my letter, and they say, well, what's the problem? Or we don't see a violation. There's pictures of some of the problems there. The 2014 thing that the gentleman from Waste Management mentioned, I probably brought that to the head because I finally got, they were mining outside of the landfill permitted area, and so I said, well, I finally got them. They're mining without a permit. Well, I actually found it in 2012. They should have had a Dogami permit, and they didn't have one there either. Now they're building stuff in the pictures in my exhibit outside the perimeter of the permitted landfill, and the DEQ says, well, we don't see a problem there. We just approve it and such. Anyway, when you get dirt for, he said you need it for cover, you need to build retaining walls, you need final there. Well, when you take dirt to do all that, it comes from somewhere. Nobody is looking, where is it coming from? Well, we have a process of, okay, if you're going to take the dirt from there to put it here, you got to fix it, the hole that you dug to take it. And the DEQ doesn't do that. I've looked through all the reports of the current plans. It's like 856 pages. There's no reclamation plans in there. I urge you to leave Dogami in charge. I've dealt with those people. They're a wonderful group of people, talented, very concerned. Don't pass this bill. Read my letter. They Waste Management owns 588 acres. That landfill is going to impact a lot more than the footprint of that landfill, and that's really what we're talking about.
Thank you, Mr. Rydell.
I'll be happy to answer any questions. Great. I'm sorry I'm wearing my sunglasses. My glasses broke in the car on the way here.
I've had that experience. Yes.
I hope if you do plan to vote for this, before you do that, you'll do the honor of come and visit my farm. I have 72 beautiful lambs. Bring your kids, but I would like you to see what it is you will be impacting.
Thank you.
I'm happy. I spent a lot of time putting on talks to the American Society of Civil Engineers, the Oregon Environmental Professionals. I would be happy to address any question you have. The reason I quit was I was engineer in charge. I'm responsible to ensure that the plans are built to contract specifications. They weren't. I had no control. My only solution was to leave. Now the permit engineer, I ask him, when did you change the grade from 4-to-1 slope to 3.5-to-1? Well, the administrative rules allow it. Well, that's like adding 5 stories to a skyscraper in downtown Portland because the zoning allows it. You know, you got to look at the structures and such. And so it's like asking a building permit inspector to inspect the building without a copy of the plans. And I said, well, can I get a copy of the plans? And he says, well, you can go to downtown Portland and pour through the boxes after you fill out a Freedom of Information Act request. Yes. None of that landfill has been designed to the current earthquake standards, and 52% of the garbage is in the original floodplain. Yes. And you don't know that Portland Metro has been dumping garbage in the floodplain for 30 years until I pointed it out in 2012. It's a disaster. Thank you for letting me speak. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And read my letter. It's interesting.
Yes. Thank you. Okay, our final panel, we have Susan Meredith, Sid Friedman, and Sal Peralta.
That's
your chair?
Okay, Ms. Meredith, you want to start?
No, I wanted to be last.
Okay.
Well, you should have been sitting in that chair. No.
Oh, okay. Oh, I thought we were going left.
Let's go with
right.
Mr. Friedman.
My mistake.
He's already warmed up.
Senator Dembrough, committee members, I'm testifying on behalf of Friends of Yamhill County. It has been argued here by proponents that Dogami oversight of surface mining at landfills is unneeded because landfills are adequately regulated by DEQ under Chapter 459. Let's be clear, Dogami and DEQ regulate different things. Chapter 459 gives DEQ no statutory authority to regulate surface mining. That authority resides with Dogami. DEQ regulates activities at landfills like leachate, liners. DEQ, for example, requires daily cover, but it doesn't concern itself with where the topsoil for that daily cover is mined. That's a Dogami issue. This bill may or may not have anything to do with Riverbend Landfill, but Riverbend does provide a great illustration of why Dogami oversight is warranted. And that oversight is warranted irrespective of whether or not Dogami has adequate resources to carry out that oversight effectively. As you heard in 2014, Waste Management was mining topsoil in the floodplain without a permit. When it was called to DEQ's attention, DEQ said, talk to Dogami. Riverbend is located about 400 feet from the Yamhill River, and it plans to mine about 500,000 to 600,000 cubic feet of topsoil from the floodplain between the garbage dump and the river. That's an activity that DEQ does not regulate. That topsoil is intended to be used and mined for daily and interim and final cover. It will be mined to fill wetlands within a proposed expansion area, and it will be mined to fill a portion of a stream listed as habitat for listed steelhead and salmon. I hear the dinger, so I'm going to wrap up, but those are not activities that they regulate the landfill activities, but not the mining activities. So to close, it is absolutely appropriate for state agencies to review these activities, these mining activities, and 1036 would limit that review. For those reasons, a no vote is warranted. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Sal.
Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sal Peralta. I live in McMinnville, Oregon, and I'm testifying today on behalf of the Independent Party and its 120,000 members statewide. We see this as a bill that clearly weakens legal protections for local farmers and other stakeholders affected by landfills, particularly the Riverbend Landfill, by eliminating the authority of Dogami to regulate construction and final cover operations at landfills that have been issued a permit. The issue was brought to my attention by IPO members and other stakeholders in the Southern Yamhill Valley, including local farmers, winemakers, and members of the McMinnville City Council. I've followed the Riverbend Landfill issue for more than a decade, having met with Waste Management staff and its opponents, assisted both sides in distributing informational articles that were widely distributed in the local community, and have attended numerous public hearings and followed the issue in the local press.
Sid Friedman gave excellent testimony about why this is needed for the Riverbend landfill specifically. And I would just argue that given the direction that the Federal Environmental Protection Agency is taking under the new administration, I question whether this is the time for Oregon to weaken environmental protections for stakeholders who are affected by the actions of large companies like Waste Management. I also question whether the Oregon DEQ has an adequate track record to trust them with the sole regulatory authority over how these landfills are mitigated. I note that the Eugene Weekly ran a story in February showing that the DEQ has allowed 75% of Oregon's 350 largest industrial and municipal plants to discharge waste, despite the fact that they've had expired permits, some of which haven't been updated for more than two decades. Similarly, the agency's response to known air quality problems in Portland was characterized by the Oregonian as timid, leaderless, and consistently influenced by industry interests. Stakeholders in Yamhill County have similar concerns with respect to how the agency addresses landfill operations. Finally, I'm concerned that the proposal will punch a significant hole in the state's regulatory framework that protects shareholders from the impact of neighboring properties like these landfills. This body shouldn't be bending the state regulation to allow powerful companies like Waste Management to circumvent inconvenient rules that are designed to protect stakeholders. Here, Genovo.
Thank you, Mr. Peralta. Okay, your time has come, Ms. Meredith.
All right, thank you, Senator Dembrough and committee. I simply want to say that I hope you can see after the testimony that you heard this afternoon that this is a clear end run, certainly if not openly proposed by Waste Management. They stand to benefit directly, and our community stands to be hurt. The lack of having any oversight, as Mr. Friedman pointed out, is appalling. And I think that in the consideration of this bill, that if you would understand what the impacts will be, that they will take the soil, it will save them millions of dollars from having to purchase the soil off-site, and they will leave the land unrehabilitated, unreclaimed, and we will have to live with it forever. So thank you for listening to all of us, and I affirm everything that all the opponents said.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Robles.
So if I've heard all the testimony correctly, though, they do have a DEQ permit right now.
Waste Management currently has a DEQ permit and a Dogami permit.
Okay.
They have applied for an expansion, both a vertical and a lateral expansion, both of which require an additional or a new permit from DEQ.
And there's no Dogami. Interest. We don't know. And Dogami, yeah.
Pardon?
And Dogami currently, right?
I don't know the terms of it.
Well, the Dogami permit has to be renewed annually.
Okay.
So some of the fill that they would presumably mine under a renewed Dogami permit would be used for construction of the new expanded landfill, should that be approved, as well as for the daily operations of the landfill.
Right, but it seems that what we heard from Mr. Maiden is that Dogami wasn't aware, or nobody seemed to be aware for a while that Dogami had oversight. And so I'm just wondering, do you have any idea what the interaction has been with Dogami?
That's a better question for Mr. Maitland. If I understand it correctly, the exemption for construction projects was removed for whatever reason, apparently at the behest of the aggregate community for business reasons. But by removing that exemption, that should also now bring in the construction of the new cells, the roads, et cetera, under Dogami purview. And I don't think it was anyone's intention at any time to take something like, a 500,000 cubic foot surface mining operation of topsoil and remove that from state agency review, remove that from Dogami review. That seems inappropriate regardless of the history.
I think we have some research to do here. But thank you. Thank you, this panel and all the panels, for making us aware of potential intricacies in our policy, which seems to happen all the time.
Thank you. You have an unenviable job.
What makes us so excited? Oh, we do have. What? Where is she? Look at you.
That was my problem.
What did you do this weekend?
I got my hair done.
My gosh. How about Mary Kyle?
Is she here?
Is Mary Kyle McCurdy here?
She had to go to another appointment.
All right.
Chair Dimbro, Senator Roblin, I'll be very, very brief. Yes. Marianne Nash here today on behalf of the Oregon Farm Bureau.
Who you are.
That is who I am. We have been involved in the River Bend landfill for a few years, primarily through the land use process, and I do not purport to be a permitting expert. Certainly, nor do we want to have another industry have to get another permit just to check a box. What we'd heard concerns about is the actual removal of the topsoil that then is used in the landfill. And just as a general kind of policy matter, we want to make sure that there is an agency that is reviewing removal of topsoil that could otherwise be valuable farmland, and just having some oversight over that process. And so whether it's through DEQ or DOGAMI, I certainly don't purport to be an expert on it. And it sounds like the DOGAMI permit at this point is fairly cursory. But I think, as you said, warrants further research and further conversation, because as I started to investigate, I also got a little confused about the current regulatory structure. And so I think it's just something we want to pay attention to in terms of the actual mining of the topsoil aspect. So that'll conclude. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Marianne. Any questions, Senator? Okay. Thank you. Okay. With that, I'm going to close our hearing on Senate Bill 1036. And we will carry over Senate Bill 745. That fiscal did not come in. It's still being analyzed. And as I mentioned earlier, Senate Bill 115 is carried over. So with that, we are adjourned.
So that one has a subsequent bill.
We are adjourned.